Chapter 50. Mass Murderers. Between June 1918 and April 1926, the district of Rudraprayag in northern India was terrorised by a savage killer who dispatched his victims by tearing their throats out. He claimed 126 lives, and yet when the man who finally shot him saw the body, he was surprised. Here was no fiend who, while watching me through the long night hours, had rocked and rolled with silent fiendish laughter at my vain attempts to outwit him and licked his lips in anticipation of the time when, finding me off my guard for one brief moment, he would get the opportunity he was waiting for of burying his teeth in my throat. The deadly killer was only an old leopard, whose muzzle was grey and whose lips lacked whiskers. Yet over a period of 8 years he had brought more terror to Rudraprayag than Jack the Ripper brought to Whitechapel or Peter Curtin to Dusseldorf. The hunter, Jim Corbett, ended the reign of terror with a single bullet through the shoulder. Why is it, then, that we feel no horror when we read of the man-eater? Because, as Jim Corbett said, this was the best hated and most feared animal in all India, whose only crime, not against the laws of nature but against the laws of man, was that he had shed human blood with no object of terrorising man, but only in order that he might live. This goes to the very heart of the matter. When killing is performed in this clean, natural way, we feel no horror, because there is no evil involved. It's the human capacity for evil, for cruelty, that frightens us. And here we face a strange paradox. The worst modern criminals, from Jack the Ripper to Richard Speck and Dean Call, are beasts of prey in the most precise sense. They stalk through modern cities like a hungry tiger, completely indifferent to the fear and suffering of their victims. Their only desire is to satisfy an appetite. A typical case is that of Jerry Thompson, who was not a mass murderer but simply a rapist. His one and only murder victim was found on the morning of June the 17th, 1935, in a ditch in the cemetery at Peoria in Illinois. She was a pretty girl, and her white dress had been pulled up under her armpits, and torn underwear lay nearby. The medical report revealed that she had been raped and strangled. She was identified as 19-year-old Mildred Hallmark, a waitress who had vanished the evening before shortly after leaving the cafeteria where she worked. When the police appealed for information, several girls came forward and disclosed that they had also been raped. The attacker was a good-looking young man who had offered them a lift and then driven them to a quiet place and forced them to submit. The police decided to make a general appeal through the newspapers, asking for all women who had been attacked to come forward with a promise of complete anonymity. They hoped that one of these women might be able to give them some clue to the identity of the rapist. The response startled them. More than 50 women came forward, and it became clear that the police were looking for a highly successful sex maniac. In many cases, he had stopped beside a girl walking along a lonely street and dragged her into the car. If she resisted or screamed, he silenced her with a violent punch on the jaw or to the stomach. He would drive to a lonely place, undress the girl, and commit rape. Then he would take out a camera and take photographs of her naked, sprawled in obscene positions. He would tell the girl that if she told the police, her name would appear in the newspapers, and everyone would know what had happened to her. There are few girls who do not prefer privacy to revenge. 5 days after the discovery of Mildred Hallmark's body, the police had the break they needed. A girl named Grace Ellsworth told them that she had been picked up by a clean-cut, well-spoken young man who had offered her a lift. In an empty road, he stopped the car and tried to kiss her. When she slapped his face, he hit her on the jaw and then beat her up so viciously that she was incapable of resisting as he undressed her. Afterwards, he dragged her into the headlights of the car, took photographs of her with a box camera, and warned her that if she reported him to the police, the pictures would be sent to her friends and relatives. And then, some weeks later, a man had been introduced to her at a dance. She was certain that this was the rapist. When she asked him if they hadn't met before, he denied it, but she was sure. The man had been introduced to her as Jerry Thompson. The police had no way of tracking down Jerry Thompson, but they suspected that Mildred Hallmark had known her killer. She was a shy girl who would never have got into a car with a stranger. They went to her father, who worked in a tractor factory in East Peoria, and asked him if he knew a Jerry Thompson. He did. Thompson worked in the machine shop and was a neighbour of theirs. Thompson proved to be a handsome young man in his mid-twenties, who was engaged to be married. He flatly denied being the rapist, but Grace Ellsworth picked him out from a lineup, and a lie detector test revealed that he knew more than he would admit about the murder. The detective in charge of the case shocked a confession out of him by throwing Mildred Hallmark's ripped underwear into his lap. Thompson broke down. He confessed to picking up Mildred, offering her a lift, and taking her to the cemetery. She had resisted, and he had struck her under the chin and throttled her into unconsciousness before tearing off her clothes and raping her on the back seat. Then, he said, he realised that she was dead. In his room, the police found dozens of photographs of the naked women he had raped, and a diary detailing dozens of rapes that he had committed since the age of 16. He was electrocuted on October the 15th, 1935. The Thompson case is interesting because we can see that he was living by the law of the jungle. All healthy young men, particularly the dominant 5%, would like to be able to make love to dozens of pretty girls. No doubt it's partly fear and caution that prevents them from becoming Jerry Thompsons, but it's also, perhaps, a sense of decency. They don't want to hurt another human being, any more than they would want to set fire to a haystack or torture a cat, and so desire is outweighed by revulsion. Jerry Thompson was obviously a man of exceptionally strong sexual desires, but his photograph, with its cold eyes and slightly cruel mouth, also reveals that he lacked the human warmth that would have led him to restrain these desires. He may not have been evil or cruel by nature, but after the first few rapes he would begin to think of himself as a criminal, a lone beast of prey, and so develop this aspect of his personality. Thompson's rapes were committed between the mid-1920s and 1935. This was the age of sex crime, especially in America. During the Second World War, the rate of sex crime rose steadily, which is to be expected when thousands of men are away from home, deprived of their wives. But it continued to rise after the war. Why? Because men who thought that they were coming home to a new world where they would be treated like heroes found themselves in the same old ruthless mechanized civilization where they were mere cogs in a wheel. Such a civilization produces an effect which Karl Marx called alienation, the feeling of not belonging. The mass murderers of the 50s and 60s were all alienated men, outsiders. Haig, Heath, Christie, Richard Speck, Howard Unruh, Charles Manson, Charles Whitman, Ian Brady. Not all these men were sex criminals. Haig was motivated by money, Unruh and Whitman and Manson by paranoid hatred of society. But the sense of alienation meant that they had no fellow feeling for their victims. And the Richard Speck case shows something even more disturbing, the alienation turning into cruelty. Not sadism, Speck didn't actually torture any of his victims, but he took pleasure in terrorising them. Speck's orgy of murder came to light just after 5 o'clock in the morning on Thursday, July the 14th, 1966, when a girl rushed out onto the balcony of a nurse's hostel on the south side of Chicago and began screaming. Two patrolmen who rushed into the building found a nauseating scene. In various rooms there were the naked bodies of 8 women. Most of them had been strangled and also stabbed many times. Their hands had been tied behind them. None of them had been raped, but a perverted sexual attack had been made on one of them, Gloria Davey. The one survivor, a Filipino girl named Corazon Amuro, told how there had been a knock on her bedroom door sometime after midnight. She opened it and found herself facing a man who smelt of alcohol and who held a gun. He had a pockmarked face and blonde hair. This was Richard Speck, a 25-year-old seaman. Speck rounded up 6 girls into one dormitory bedroom and tied their hands with sheets that he had cut up with a knife. He kept explaining that he needed money to get to New Orleans, and he promised not to hurt them. This indicates that, in spite of his intention of committing murder, he still maintained some fellow feeling for the intended victims. 3 more nurses came home late. Speck took their money and tied them. Finally, Speck took one of the girls out of the room. A few minutes later, he took another, and they heard a cry. Corazon Amuro was a courageous girl, more dominant than the others. She urged them to free themselves and to try to jump the man. They replied that he didn't appear to be violent and that they had better sit still. Miss Amuro decided to roll under a bed, where she hid. The man continued to come in and out for hours, and then all was quiet. When an alarm clock went off at 5 o'clock, Miss Amuro rolled out from under the bed, crawled onto the balcony, and began to scream for help. Speck had left fingerprints all over the place, and Corazon Amuro was able to give an exact description of him, even down to a tattoo on his arm with the words, "Born to raise hell." From the seaman's knots that bound the dead girls, the police guessed that the man was a sailor. There was a labour exchange, much used by sailors, not far away, and the police soon established the identity of the man they were seeking. Half an hour after midnight on the following Sunday, Speck was taken into the Chicago Cook County Hospital, his wrist slashed in a suicide attempt. The doctor who attended him saw the tattoo and called the police. Psychiatrists who examined Speck learned that he had been known at school as a sulky loner who hated his stepfather. He drifted from job to job, labourer, garbage collector, truck driver, and seaman. At the age of 20, he married a 15-year-old girl, and they had a baby daughter whom he adored. But after 5 years of fighting, they divorced. He drank heavily and took drugs, yellow jackets, redbirds, amital and soconal drugs that can cause hallucinations. In Dallas, Texas, earlier in 1965, he had attacked a young girl as she was parking her car, holding a carving knife across her throat. Sentenced to 18 months in prison, he was soon released on parole, which he instantly skipped. To drinking companions, he was known as a braggart, who boasted about all the women he had slept with, but who never seemed to be able to date a girl. In April 1966, when Speck had returned to Monmouth, Illinois, where his relatives lived, a barmaid named Mary Pierce vanished from a tavern where Speck drank. Her naked body was later found in a hoghouse behind the tavern. Speck had often asked her for a date. After leaving Monmouth, Speck had worked on Great Lakes ore boats, but had been rushed into hospital for an appendix operation in early May. He began to date a nurse there. She found him gentle, but full of hatred of society. He talked vengefully of two people in Texas he wanted to kill, and he told someone else that he intended to return to Texas and to kill his ex-wife, Shirley. Significantly, the only Chicago nurse who was sexually assaulted closely resembled his wife. On the day before the murders, he had been drinking heavily in Chicago bars. Chicago was in the midst of a heat wave, and there were riots when Negro children turned on fire hydrants to bathe and the police tried to stop them. Towards midnight, drunk and drugged, Speck approached the hostel that he had often passed, the building that was full of young girls. He was like a fox creeping into a chicken house, and the lengths of time he took to kill 8 girls suggests that he was enjoying every moment of it. For a few hours, he was a sultan with absolute power over a harem of girls. It was 2 years after Speck had been sentenced that the police of Salem, Oregon, realised that they were dealing with another sex killer who had claimed several victims. Linda Slauson of Aloha vanished in January 1968. Jan Susan Whitney, 23, had vanished from McMinnville in November 1968. 16-year-old Stephanie Vilko, who vanished in July 1968, was found in March 1969 on the banks of Gales Creek. Her body was so decomposed that the cause of death could not be established. On April the 23rd, 1969, Linda Saley, 22, vanished when she went out shopping for a birthday present for her boyfriend. And on May the 10th, a fisherman on the bank of the Long Tom River near Corvallis saw a body floating beneath the surface. It proved to be female, half-clothed, without bra or panties, and had been held down by a heavy car part. It was Linda Saley, and she had been raped and strangled. Not far away, the police found another body, 19-year-old Karen Sprinker, who had vanished on March the 27th. Her underclothes were also missing. She had been raped and strangled, and was held down by part of a car engine. In April, a 15-year-old schoolgirl had been grabbed by a man who tried to force her into a car, but she managed to break away. Not long after, 2 schoolgirls had seen a man dressed in women's clothes in the car park of a big store. The police thought it was possible he was an ordinary transvestite, a man who dresses in women's clothes because he wants to be a woman. However, soon after finding the 2 bodies, the police had a break. A girl student from Oregon State University told them about a date she had had with a strange man. He had claimed to be a Vietnam veteran and had spent the evening with her in the lounge of her dormitory and told her that she ought to be sad on account of the girls who had been killed. He seemed a gentle, quietly spoken man, but it was only afterwards that she began to wonder if it was worth telling the police. It was one of hundreds of tips, but they checked it. It led them to a mild 30-year-old married electrician and photographer named Jerry Brudos, and they were soon convinced that this man, who made a habit of telephoning girls and claiming to be a Vietnam veteran, knew something about the murders. He had a police record for stealing women's underwear and for trying to force two girls to strip by threatening them with a knife. He had been caught near the women's dormitory of the Oregon State University carrying stolen women's clothing and wearing a bra and panties. The police searched his home near the state hospital to which he had been committed after the sexual charges. Brudos's wife seemed to have no suspicion that her husband had been leading a double life. Her time was taken up tending their two children. But she admitted that he spent much time in the photographer's darkroom adjoining the house. In this darkroom, the police found what they were looking for. Photographs of the dead girls. It became clear that Brudos had kidnapped them, taken them to the studio, and there suspended them from the ceiling by their wrists while he had committed sexual assaults and photographed them. Brudos confessed to killing the four missing girls, although the death of Stephanie Vilko, the 16-year-old, is still unsolved. He was sentenced to life imprisonment. Comparing these three cases, Thompson, Speck and Brudos, we immediately note the violence and the sadism of the more recent ones. Thompson, a typical killer of the age of sex crime, only wanted to possess attractive girls, with or without their consent. Speck and Brudos had a deep psychopathic hatred of women. It would not, of course, be true to say that torture murders were unknown in the age of sex crime. One of the grimmest cases on record is that of Donald Fern, a 23-year-old railway mechanic of Pueblo, Colorado, who in 1942 kidnapped Alice Porter, drove her into the desert to an old adobe church used by the Indians, and whipped and bound her with red-hot wires. He killed her with a hammer after raping her and threw the body into a well. He was executed in the gas chamber. There was the mysterious moonlight murderer of Texarkana, Texas, who in 1946 attacked courting couples and in two cases killed the man and then spent hours torturing and raping the girl before killing her. A burnt-out car found near the murder site suggests that the murderer destroyed the evidence. Police had tire tracks of the murderer's car and then committed suicide by flinging himself under a train. However, crimes like these are solitary examples of sick perversion, which stand out from the general pattern of crime as exceptions. The murders of Richard Speck fit all too neatly into a pattern of crime that is becoming increasingly familiar in our time. There is a strange sense of lack of motivation. We're confronted with patterns of crime that would have baffled criminologists of the old school like Lombroso or Ivan Bloch. In February 1968, the bullet-riddled body of August Norrie, a landscape gardener, was found on a hillside at San Mateo County in California. A few months later, a pretty 18-year-old ponytailed blonde named Penny Bjorklund confessed that she had killed him for fun. He was a stranger who had offered her a lift, and she had suddenly felt an urge to shoot him, for no reason. In June 1972, Santa Barbara police arrested a man in connection with a supermarket stick-up. He was 47-year-old Sherman McCrary, and the investigation led police to arrest McCrary's wife, Carolyn, with his daughter Ginger, his son Danny, and his son-in-law, Carl Taylor. And as the police investigated the itinerant family, they came to the conclusion that they had been jointly responsible for murdering more than 20 young women, mostly waitresses and shop assistants, who had been abducted and raped over the past 2 years. The women were apparently aware that their husbands were involved in orgies of robbery and rape, but felt that a housewife should be seen and not heard. And so the mass murders continue. After Manson, John Lindley Frazier, Juan Corona, Herb Mullin and the McCrarys, Edmund Kemper, Jerry Schaffer, Dean Call, in all these cases there can be no doubt that the fundamental problem is alienation. Karl Marx would have smiled grimly. But if he was still alive, he would have to admit that Das Kapital holds no solution to this baffling and disturbing problem of our time.